Aloha and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. How are you doing, Beth Ann?
Good morning. Doing all right, thank you. How about you?
Not too bad. We keep hearing the phrase doubling down with regard to the president's activities, and his latest double down is on immigration.
And we've been talking about that since the first executive order in January. Now we have another one set to go into effect next week.
Right.
And we're going to talk about that this morning with a, through a different bit of lens, rather. How art reflects politics, you know, is nothing new. But what may be new is how art will respond this time around in an era of changing relationships with immigrants and refugees. Of course, the latest executive order from President Trump on immigration will go in effect on March 16. This week, MIT writing professor and Pulitzer Prize-winning author Junot Diaz is in Honolulu to speak at a series of events about the nexus of art and immigration. First, he's here to talk with us this morning. Welcome to the program, and thank you for making some time in your schedule.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
When we talk about how art and activism go hand in hand, we can point to various movements looking back over our shoulder. But how do you see it happening this time around in such a very different political climate for example, your students?
Well, that's the best part. We don't have any idea yet how it's going to play out. What strikes me as fascinating is how generative the response has been to the Trump administration, how these enormous reservoirs of creativity have begun to just explode. It's been rather remarkable to see. And how it's going to all play out, no idea. But that art is forming the backbone of resistance and opening up spaces for people to gather. And that's, I think, patent.
That kind of passion is sometimes tough to sustain, particularly when you're talking about movements forming and how they take a period of time to become actual bona fide movements. In the way you are talking about now, the fact that we don't know so much of what we don't know, what are you hearing back from your students that might give us at least an indication?
Well, I mean, it's not just my students. I'm a person who's involved in community work outside of the university. Ultimately, this idea that one can sustain anything is just a fantasy, a great fantasy that people have. We're human beings. We're easily distracted. We have life cycles. We're more about disruption than we are about continuity in many ways. And what matters most, I think, that I'm hearing is that we're seeing a whole entire generation, both young and old, acquiring a new vocabulary around resistance, acquiring a new idiom around our ideals as people and as communities. Folks who had never before kind of raised questions about, well, what are our values? What's worth fighting for? Are beginning to entertain those questions and to grapple with them. And that's not insignificant. And that has a longitudinal effect even beyond the moments where these movements go quiescent.
For those movements and for the fact that we know that they will sometimes simply just peter out, that ethos that has moved generationally from, say, some of our parents in the Vietnam era to some of us who came along a little later sometimes has gone fallow, too. And we've heard from many who are in the generation of 60s activists that, you know, what's wrong with the rest of you? And they're looking to the generation even, you know, younger than millennials to keep it moving or to keep it going. And I sometimes feel for them in the fact that they think that somehow a lot of what they did and a lot of their work has gone unnoticed by at least the generation that came immediately after. Do you see any of those parallels or any of those types of those patterns as you talk to communities throughout the country?
Well, look, we belong to a country where public education has been systematically gutted. We belong to a country where our imaginary around our own histories, especially histories of resistance and struggle, the histories that come out of the 60s globally, have been completely erased and demonized. Given all of these assaults, given all of these erasures, the fact that a lot of these questions are still on the table, that some folks have access to this information is, I think, something that we should celebrate. In a different world, I promise you that there's a different reality out there where this same system has played out and we haven't done as well and maintaining the memories from the 60s and 70s global struggles as we have here, we sometimes forget that we're doing the best we can. Now, for me, I have great hope that these things are not as linear, one-to-one, as people like to pretend they are. That's not the way history works. History is more like quantum physics. It has spooky effects. We don't know the influence and the impact we've made, even when things seem that we've made no impact and we've been entirely forgotten. A generation that comes down the line rediscovers and reinvigorates and recuperates efforts that folks have thought were meaningless. And that's something that we have to remember, is that this is not an easy struggle, that there are going to be tremendous setbacks, that there's all the power and all the money directed at making us forget who we are, and yet we continue to push on, and that's not a minor thing.
That also seems to say that you need to take the long view.
Or how about just simply that often even the narratives of how we evaluate how well we've done are influenced by people who want us to fail. I think a lot of this history of who we are and what we've done and the sort of cynicism and the defeatism feeds right into the narratives of the hegemony, the narratives that tell us, see, these movements are stupid, these movements are irrelevant, these movements are frivolous. And it's easy to pick up that logic, to pick up that flow. Certainly a long view, but also a sense of possibility and hope, the very thing that drove and created these spaces and created these movements, I think has to be maintained even in the darkest of times.
For a lot of people, they're seeing dark times right now, and trying to access that hope is a little difficult. There are many who have come through this studio who have said words like, I'm so depressed, I'm so upset, I don't know what to do. And yet they're in positions where they can do something, and the response seems to be, well, what are you going to do? What would you suggest they do?
I always say it's the same thing. It always looks dark till we help someone who's worse off than us. Any of my students would tell me, oh, I'm feeling depressed, I don't know if I can go on. I'm just like, let's go to the elderly home right down the street and spend an hour reading and talking to those folks. Because what we recall when we help people who are less better off than us is not how bad we have it. What we recall is our tremendous agency vis-a-vis other people. And that, I think, is salutary.
It's a way of being able to reaccess our own humanity.
And to stop narrativizing this from the point of view that we're disenfranchised and that we have no agency. Everybody has agency. Everyone. And how we use our agency determines whether this is going to be a long, dark age or a very short one, whether the dawn will come bright or it won't come at all.
You're here to speak about a number of things, but the title of one of your talks is I Will Build a Great Wall, Notes on Borders, Immigrants, and the Future in the Age of Trump. If you had to leave us with a few bits from that that you would like us to think about, what would they be?
I think here in Hawaii, all of these factors are playing out very clearly. It doesn't need me to spell them out too much. But ultimately, we can no more cruelly legislate against immigration in such an irresponsible way as we could legislate against climate change. Immigration is a reality. We have to begin to create cultures that allow us to be hospitable, allow us to respond to the new communities around us in ways that maintain our humanity. We are going to need these skills. The future is going to be very challenging. We know this. Climate change is going to disrupt the planet. It's going to just throw millions of people out of their spaces, out of their islands. And we're going to have to figure out how we live in this world together. We created this problem. Just because we happen to be in higher ground doesn't mean it isn't our responsibility. It's all of our responsibility. And learning cultures of hospitality, of compassion, are going to be essential for our survival. You can build walls and you can legislate. And if you do that, we will all be destroyed. On the other hand, if we create cultures and climates of openness, of dealing with this issue in a humane way, we will survive.
On that hopeful note, I want to thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Junot Diaz was born in the Dominican Republic and raised in New Jersey. His first novel, The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde, won the 2008 Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Critics Circle Award. His 2015 work, This Is How You Lose Her, was a New York Times bestseller and National Book Award finalist. A professor of writing at MIT, Junot Diaz is in Honolulu for a series of events, including the lecture we just mentioned, I Will Build a Great Wall, Notes on Borders, Immigrants, and the Future in the Age of Trump. You can see our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation, for the full list of events.